This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Friday and time for the Week in Review, starting with, yeah, you guessed it, Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Russia. Because, you know, first he said he didn't meet with any Russian officials, then he said he did, but not for political purposes, and then...
I have now decided to recuse myself from any existing or future investigations of any matter relating in any way to the campaigns for President of the United States.
And that recusal came after the Washington Post reported that Sessions met twice last year with the Russian ambassador, which appeared to contradict what he said under oath during his Senate confirmation hearings earlier this year. Here's his January exchange with Senator Al Franken.
If there is any evidence that anyone affiliated with the Trump campaign communicated with the Russian government in the course of this campaign, what will you do?
Senator Franken, I'm not aware of any of those activities. I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I did not have communications with the Russians, and I'm unable to comment on it.
President Donald Trump put out a tweet storm last night defending Sessions. He wrote, "It's a total witch hunt." Well, joining us now to talk about all of this and more of the week's news are our panelists. Today, it's Tiziana Deering, co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College and a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Tiziana, it's great to see you.
Nice to see you.
Also with us is D.R. Tucker, political contributor to the Washington Monthly and Cube Innovations. D.R., it's great to have you back on the show as well.
Thanks. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Okay, well, let's just start with you, D.R. Give me your headline here on your take of this week that Jeff Sessions has had.
I bet you he is second-guessing wanting that job after all. it just goes to show you that, you know, this whole thing in terms of people, you know, these connections with the Russians and connections with you just look at it and you just ask yourself, you know, I was telling a friend last night, elections have consequences, does it not? And when elections go in the way they went last November, you see the horrifying consequences and fairly embarrassing from an international standpoint, such consequences. Having said that, there's still a push. There's still many people calling for him to resign. I think his ego is too large for him to ever resign, and I don't see Trump pushing him out the door either.
Well, and amongst those, Tiziana, calling for Sessions to resign is the entire Massachusetts congressional delegation.
Everybody. Yeah, you know, it's a really difficult situation. Actually, you know what? No, I'm not going to say that. It's not a difficult situation, but it's a frustrating one. And the thing I keep finding myself thinking as I'm watching this and everything else in this car crash is we used to say that you didn't avoid a conflict of interest. If you were a good leader, you avoided the appearance of a conflict of interest. That was the ethical bar that you were supposed to hold yourself accountable to. And by that bar, we are done. We are just done after what happened with the Attorney General this week.
Well, so that's an interesting point because appearance or not, Jeff Sessions spoke on Fox News last night and he asserted that he never discussed the campaign, underscore that part, with Russia's ambassador. Here he is.
I don't recall any discussion of the campaign in any significant way. It was in no way some sort of coordinating of an effort or doing anything improper. And I don't believe anybody that was in that meeting would have seen or believed I said one thing that was improper or unwise.
No, the whole thing, if there's an investigation or even not, is going to hinge on that.
Yeah, but 2 days ago, he couldn't remember the conversation at all. And now we are asserting 48 hours later with great certainty that we did not say blah, 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 or hear blah, blah, blah. And it's this kind of cascading of no, and then maybe, but not over here, but then yes, but I can't remember. Oh, wait, I do remember. There is no credibility down that chain.
Well, DR, though, I mean, Sean Spicer at his White House press conference said that he said, you know, shame on people for playing politics with this. That was his take. What do you make of that?
How can a guy say shame on people for playing politics when the man has no shame? And as we see this sort of circus play on, you begin to wonder if any of the players in the administration have any shame or have any sense of ethics or morals or decency whatsoever. And it appears that the answer to that is a profound no.
Mm. Well, we spoke with Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas yesterday on the show about this, and here's what she said.
Given the national security issues that are at stake with the alleged Russian interference, I think his failure to disclose his own meetings with Russian officials while he was under oath during his confirmation hearings, I think demonstrates his disregard for the truth.
And Congresswoman Song, as we mentioned earlier, is one of the folks saying that Sessions should resign. She said, or at the very least recuse himself, which he has done. Now, honestly, to me, so maybe he has an argument. I'm not a lawyer. Maybe he has an argument to saying that when he met with in September with the Russian ambassador, it was under the auspices of his work on the Senate Armed Services Committee. The meeting that really has me perplexed is the one that happened at the Republican National Convention, which there's been reporting in the past 48 hours again that he spent campaign money to go to that convention. So I can't see how there's any justification other than politics and campaigns for him to meet with any kind of ambassador.
I completely agree. I mean, the minute you take it into the context of a convention where we were taking the person he was working for and putting him on the ticket as the Republican nominee, then it would almost be, you're coded in the context. Does that make sense? I mean, you're literally coded. It's like you put it on, the context on, and therefore, there's no way to have a conversation that is not steeped in and imbued with that context. It's not credible.
So do you think he should resign, or is recusal enough? Because he has taken himself out of the stream regarding any investigation from the DOJ into Russia's meddling in the election.
So I thought recusal was enough until I heard your interview with Nancy Gertner, the former federal judge, who argued that the bar for prosecuting people for perjury by the Justice Department is quite low. That, frankly, by the bar they usually use to prosecute, he'd be prosecuted. And how do you have him in charge of those prosecutions if he's not being held to the same standard?
Well, we have a cut from what Judge Gertner told us yesterday.
At the very least, this ought to be investigated. And at the very least, it has implications for his fitness to be the chief enforcement officer of the United States. At the very most, it's a criminal charge. Lying to Congress, lying under oath, a material misstatement that you knew was false, is a 5-year felony.
You know, the other thing that Judge Gertner told us is that she has personal experience testifying before Congress. She had to go through a Senate confirmation process in order to become a federal judge. And so she said in her case, they prepared her for 4 straight days for all the kind of questions she should have got. So she can't imagine a circumstance in which Jeff Sessions didn't know or wasn't prepared to talk accurately and truthfully about Russia.
It goes to the unlimited arrogance on the part of Sessions, on the part of Trump, on the part of Spicer, on the part of these individuals. They basically figured that, you know, it essentially that laws don't matter, decency doesn't matter, truth doesn't matter, power matters. And of course, when you have that sort of mentality, you have inevitably disaster.
Well, DR, let me ask you about this, because I just want to read a little bit more of what the president tweeted out recently about Jeff Sessions. This is sort of the combination of 4 or 5 tweets together. He tweeted that Jeff Sessions is an honest man. He did not say anything wrong. He could have stated his response more accurately, but it was clearly not intentional. The whole narrative is a way of saving face for Democrats losing an election that everyone thought they were supposed to win. The Democrats are overplaying their hand. They lost the election, and now they have lost their grip on reality. The real stories of all the illegal leaks of classified and other information, it's a total witch hunt. Now, about that point that the president makes about the Democrats overplaying their hand, I think that's in response to the calls for Sessions to resign. Mm-hmm. Do you think the president may have a point there?
I don't think so. I think it's the when he goes on that tweet storm, it's the playing of the world's smallest violin, so to speak. And I think that if there's anybody in that administration who recognizes political reality, they recognize that this could portend trouble for the 2018 midterms, if not the 2020 re-election effort, because there's going to be a point past which the American people, even people on Trump's side, decide that enough is enough, basically.
Tiziana?
Yes, I think they've been overplaying their hand a little bit. And it's in combination with the speech on Tuesday night and the strategic choices the Democrats made about how to behave in that chamber. But you take that and combine it with calls for Sessions' resignation, you know, 1.1 milliseconds after the news broke. And yes, I think that overplays one's hand a little bit. There could have been a strategic 12-hour pause there for a little bit more information to come out, some statements about we really need to understand exactly what happened in this situation, because if A happened, then the Attorney General may need to resign. It would have been a smarter, less knee-jerk reaction, and I think it would have allowed the Democrats a little more credibility with the same sort of outcome in terms of their position about where Sessions stands.
You can imagine the Democratic base, though, saying, no way, this is the time for hardball.
Yeah, I do know the Democratic base will say, no way, this is the time for hardball. But, you know, welcome to the rock and hard place that both parties live between in the last 10 to 15 years. The bases are dragging people in both directions to places of extreme that are making us not function very well as a government.
Hmm. Well, you did mention the president's address to the joint session of Congress, so let's move on and talk about that a little bit, because the president didn't necessarily make any huge revelations or present any truly detailed or new plans for his agenda for the country, but he was lauded by some for his presidential tone. So here's a little bit of tape from President Donald Trump. Here's where the point of his speech where he was talking about taking strong measures to fight terrorism. And the Boston Marathon bombing gets a mention.
We have seen the attacks at home, from Boston to San Bernardino to the Pentagon, and yes, even the World Trade Center. We have seen the attacks in France, in Belgium, in Germany, and all over the world. It is not compassionate, but reckless to allow uncontrolled entry from places where proper vetting cannot occur.
DR, what do you make of the speech?
I was mystified by the amount of praise it received in the press. I heard the speech and I thought to myself of the old biblical line about old wine and new wineskins. Basically, if you deliver offensive, questionable, inaccurate rhetoric in a modulated tone, people will give you a thumbs up. But if you look at the actual content of the speech, what was the content of the speech? Obamacare is a disaster. Regulations are bad. The immigrants are all going to kill you. And it's as if, you know, when you set a very low standard for achievement, you can jump right over that standard. And it's just amazing. And I just wish that, you know, people who are giving him hosannas would subject the content of the speech, not the tone with which it was delivered, but the content of the speech to the strictest possible scrutiny.
I agree. I mean, I tweeted a bunch after the speech and I said, you know, his tone was different than mm-hmm. the Donald Trump we've heard before. It was, I don't know if I'd necessarily call it more presidential, but it was more toned down. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the letter of what he said, I didn't necessarily see any difference from, you know, the content of the executive orders, from what he said on the campaign trail. It just seems sort of a more sober version of a campaign speech to me.
Yeah, but it was a performance. And he hit the right notes, right? You know, I found myself thinking, boy, you know, when I was in high school, the mean girls said a lot of stuff in a nice tone, right? So there is a difference between tone and substance. But if you are someone who disagrees with the president's agenda, he became a much more dangerous man for you on Tuesday night. I heard someone in a coffee shop say this week, well, he wasn't a cartoon anymore. And you can't dismiss him as easily if he's not cartoonish. And so if his agenda is one that you find threatening or concerning, and there were some deeply concerning things, I believe, in what he had to say on Tuesday night, I believe he became much more dangerous by becoming much less cartoonish on set Tuesday.
Well, and if you're one of those many people who don't believe that Donald Trump is dangerous, who support him wholeheartedly, this was the speech you wanted to hear, because it's the immediate pushback to all the criticism from, you know, from the left that Trump is unhinged. He did not seem at all unhinged on the floor of the House on that
He not
night.
Only did not seem unhinged, he wasn't unhinged. Yes, he was not unhinged.
DR, go ahead.
It's the interesting thing with regard to the coverage of it, when you heard this sort of talking point of a pivot on the part of Trump, and I thought to myself, there could never be such a pivot, because if there were a legitimate pivot, would that not disappoint some of his more hardcore supporters who like the combative Trump, who like the Trump that calls out the mainstream press and demonizes it as evil? If he ever really abandoned that beyond, you know, this moment in time, if he abandoned that permanently, wouldn't the members of his base get a little upset because he's not simply constantly punching at their perceived enemies?
Well, or maybe not, because he's shown that he can rise above that. But, it, you know, when speaking of the content of the speech, David Brooks today in the New York Times, he lamented that he felt like the speech was the final nail in the coffin for Reagan conservatism. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when you look at what Trump really wants to do, aside from, you know, talking about repealing and replacing Obamacare, he was talking about the Trumpian form of big government. Mm-hmm. Don't you think?
Definitely. It's When you look at the sort of the never Trump type of conservatives, type of Republicans, that one of the reasons they didn't like Trump is because they regard him as this sort of a ideologically flexible individual that, you know, populism and traditional conservatism don't really square. And they obviously feel that, you know, the moment Trump's instincts lean towards getting more popularity by going in the more populist direction and away from, quote unquote, limited government, he'll basically abandon any form of limited government. So that's why they never really liked him.
Mm. TT, I want to come back to you in just a second here, but I want to play another piece of tape. And this was from almost certainly the most powerful moment, at least emotionally powerful moment in the president's address. It's when he spoke about Navy SEAL Ryan Owens, who was killed during that controversial raid in Yemen, and he pointed out that that Owens' wife was attending the speech.
We are blessed to be joined tonight by Corinne Owens, the widow of U.S. Navy Special Operator, Senior Chief William Ryan Owens. Ryan died as he lived, a warrior and a hero, battling against terrorism and securing our nation.
And the applause was sustained. It went on for quite some time. And Corinne Owens was, you know, shown on camera being very emotional. Just your thoughts about that moment, Tiziana.
Shoot. I was afraid you were going to ask me about that because my feelings about it are quite complicated. So at one level, it was a time of great solidarity among people. And we need to find those places more frequently and in more sustained ways. And I was grateful for that piece of it. I really believe that we should not use people in their moments of grief. I think grief is a sacred experience that requires privacy and time. And as that applause went on, I went from a sense of solidarity to a sense of pastoral concern that here was somebody grieving deeply for a very personal and profound loss. And here we were using it lots of different ways in that moment for things that didn't have to do with the nature of her loss. And it made me very uncomfortable.
But let's pretend that this never happened. Let's not pretend that this doesn't happen. I mean, the family of Captain Humayun Khan at the Democratic National Convention. Now, Captain Khan had been killed several years ago.
Which matters. That matters.
I mean, you think that that's a significant enough difference?
I think a couple years versus a moment of grief that's a couple of weeks old.
It's still using a dead soldier for political gain.
I'm not a fan of using dead people for political anything, A. But B, we have lots of times, politically and in other places, where we use somebody else's good deeds as our own mantle. And in general, I think it's disingenuous. And so I found more pain in this moment because of the freshness of her grief. But I do think it's a fair point. Yeah, we play this game lots of different times. Not my favorite.
DR?
Watching that scene, It occurred to me that, and I was wrestling with a lot of different emotions watching that scene, but I ultimately came to the idea that I don't think Ryan Owens' widow blames Trump for the death of her husband. I know there's been some reports that the father of Ryan Owens has a big, big problem with what went down.
Very much so.
But I think that she does not put this on Trump, and therefore, in her mind, you know, this was a moment of healing that she needed, and whatever the political implications were, is a separate thing.
Yeah,
and so therefore, that, you know, whether or not it was in fact exploitative, I don't think she necessarily thinks it was.
No, that's a good point. I'll tell you what bothers me. Trump doesn't even put it on himself, right? Because he, on Fox and Friends, he said, or just basically that same day or the day before, he said that, you know, it was, quote, the generals who, quote unquote, lost him. I mean, last I checked, it doesn't matter what party you belong to. If you're in the White House, you're the commander in chief. And I think that he broke with some tradition there and not necessarily and not taking responsibility for the outcome of the missions that he approves as commander-in-chief.
I'm so grateful that you raised that, Meghna, because this is a larger theme I've been thinking about a lot. It's not just a tradition with the commander-in-chief. Having been a chief executive a couple of times, when you are the chief executive, at the end of the day, the buck stops with you. And the bigger the buck, the more you stand up and take responsibility. And so this idea, this is our life. And actually, it's not one life. There were many lives, mm-hmm. right?
Well, the civilian lives as
right.
well.
Right. And in that moment, if you are the person who gets it, you let and take the responsibility. You let the responsibility fall on you and you take it. And it concerns me when I see any chief executive who one of their strategies is it's someone else's fault.
Hmm. Well, let's take 1 minute here to talk about, to turn a corner and talk about one story unfolding here in New England before we run out of time. Different kind of chief executive issue here, because New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu is blaming New Hampshire's drug problems on the neighboring Massachusetts sanctuary city of Lawrence. He's claiming that 85% of the fentanyl in New Hampshire is coming from Lawrence. And here's a little bit of tape from Sununu.
85% of the fentanyl in this state is coming straight out of Lawrence, Massachusetts. Guess what? We're going in. And we're going to get tough on these guys. And I want to scare every dealer that wants to come across that border. We're not giving dealers 9 months in parole and probation anymore. We're putting them away for the 5, 10, and 15 years that they deserve. Because they are not dealing drugs. They are dealing death.
That sound, by the way, is courtesy of WMUR. Lawrence Mayor Dan Rivera quickly fired back. Here he is.
I think that the problem is that you think, like, oh, if we snuff out what's happening in Lawrence, it will all go away. I know he's only been on the job 60 days. But the reality is, it's like water. It will find another place to go. And we know that because we're fighting it every day.
Now, DR, first of all, we can't even verify whether or not this idea that 85% of the fentanyl in New Hampshire is coming from Lawrence. But what do you make of this claim that Sununu's making?
It goes to show you that anybody can talk tough, even if they don't have any facts. I mean, again, as you note, that this claim that 85% of the drugs are coming from Lawrence has not been verified. I don't believe it can be verified. And, you know... When he talks about drug issues in New Hampshire, how do we know that those issues are not germane to New Hampshire? You know, it's just this sort of weird sort of, you know, kind of borderline cruel, borderline sort of like, it's just, it's almost indescribably bizarre what Governor Sununu was doing. And it's good to see that there was something of a pushback by the mayor of Lawrence, because there's just no justification for that sort of, you know, slur and insult.
Well, Rivera and Sununu did talk on the phone, had apparently a productive conversation yesterday. They appeared to reconcile a little bit there. But Tiziana, what do you think?
You know, a couple of things. The first is, oh, for goodness sake, this is not a supply-side problem. This is a demand-side problem. You know, supply is an issue, but do we really believe that if we could lock up everybody in his imagination who's providing supply, suddenly we wouldn't have an opioid crisis anymore? It's a completely non-plausible argument. Second, I'm not sure that we, you know, geographic boundaries don't necessarily come into play with systems levels issues. And this is something Governor Baker himself pointed out in response right. to this tussle this week. And so the idea that there's some magical boundary line that if you can cross it and they'll just set policies the way you like them, a systems-level, complex social problem plaguing the entire nation will leave your one state alone is a boogeyman argument that suggests to me someone who doesn't understand the complexity or have a plan.
Yeah. Well, I'm riding roughshod over the clock today. We're technically out of time, but who cares? It's Friday. So give me your hubbubs real quick. Tiziana, you first.
It's High School Musical time. There are Lin-Manuel Miranda wannabes coming to an auditorium/cafeteria near you. You can see Rent in Newton. You could see High School Musical in Abington. So if you want to do theater on a budget, it's that time of year. You get some Twizzlers. You get $10. You go down to your low school high school, and you can find 20 different productions of Fiddler on the Roof.
That sounds great. And then, like you said, the next potential creator of Hamilton.
That's
amongst
right.
them. DR?
Yes, this Sunday at Northeastern University, Curry Student Center is the local Environmental Action 2017 conference, the 30th anniversary of the conference held by Toxics Action Center and the Mass Climate Action Network. The special guests will be Candy Mossett of the Indigenous Environmental Network and Lois Gibbs, the activist who brought international attention to the Love Canal scandal in the 1970s. So you can check out more on localenvironmentalaction.org, and it's sure to be a great time. I've attended the conference several years in the past. I won't be able to make it this year, but it's always a great event. event.
Yeah, it sounds terrific. Well, my hubbub, very briefly, considered a public service announcement because I know there's a lot of confusion and even frustration over the rollout of the legalization of marijuana in Massachusetts. But the Globe just had a story this week about a Springfield business that was shut down on Wednesday because they were giving customers who visited the store free samples of pot in exchange for an entrance fee, because certain readings of question four make people think that, you know, you can give away pot in exchange, since we can't technically sell it yet, you can give it away in exchange for a fee or something like that. Turns out that that is not true. So the public service announcement here says that the law allows the exchange of up to 1 ounce of marijuana as long as it's not advertised or promoted and done without remuneration. So, like, you can just flat out give it away now, but you can't do it for any kind of entrance fee. Okay, so that's my public service announcement.
Good to know.
Yeah, today's question four update. D.R. Tucker is political contributor to Washington Monthly and Cube Innovations. Thank you so much, D.R.
Thank you so much.
And Tiziana Deering, co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College. Thanks as always.
Thanks. It was great to be here.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.